Good evening. I don't want to shortchange you, so I want to get started on time. I think you will greatly enjoy tonight's presentation. How many of you are aware of William E. Colby? Very good. He is the late ambassador and former CIA director, and there happens to be an award called the William E. Colby Award, and this gentleman who is speaking here tonight very recently won the William E. Colby Award. He is named the National Washington Historian winner for 2014. We are very honored to host Mr. Logan Byrne tonight. He is, of course, from Harvard. Excuse me, wrong university. I'm looking at one thing, thinking another. He's from Yale. I know for a fact, however, he is a born and raised Connecticutite. The very first thing he said to me was, "This looks a lot like Connecticut." He is a former attorney with Sullivan and Cromwell Law Firm in New York City. He got his JD from Yale Law School. He has a particular interest in George Washington, and this book has been inspired by a paper that he wrote when he was at Yale. He is a wonderful gentleman, but interestingly enough, he is not a descendant of George Washington, but rather a descendant of another president that sort of circuitously inspired him to write about Mr. Washington. And I'll let him tell you about his ancestor in his upcoming presentation. This book has won tremendous awards throughout the United States. He is regularly featured in many of our national publications and periodicals. So I think that we will greatly enjoy him. But before I surrender my podium, I want to remind you that there will be a signing afterwards in the rotunda, and we are blessed, as always, to have our wonderful independent bookstore, The Learned Owl, here to sell his books. And then, lastly but not least, there is a box in the back of the room, you all know this, where we accept donations to continue to do further wonderful programming like this, as it costs some money to bring these people in from interesting places like Connecticut. There are also brochures in the back about our upcoming history programs, and next month we will be hosting Mr. James Robbins, who will speak to us about a native Ohioan, George Armstrong Custer. And I am very excited to tell you that in 2015 we have some phenomenal history programs coming up that I'm excited to share with you at a later date. Because I'm going to shut up now and let this gentleman tell us about Mr. Washington. So without further ado, Logan Byrne.
Wow, well, thank you so much for having me. It is so exciting to be here, and I'm so honored to be part of this Heritage series and all the amazing speakers you've had. And I just got to town today, and that's the first thing I thought is really, you know, the Connecticut Western Reserve is still living strong. And I think it's so beautiful here, I'm going to go back to Connecticut and try to convince us to try to take it back. I grew up in Milford, Connecticut, so you know that I saw Milford Road, which is right next to West Haven, Connecticut. I saw West Haven Road. As I was going, I was saying, wait a second, this seems very familiar. And then it clicked into my brain, oh, wait, this is used to be the Connecticut Western Reserve, so it makes sense. And what a gorgeous town you have. And I'm so honored to be here and proud to have the chance to speak to you all today. So one quote that really struck me when I started studying Washington was when he said, "The foundation of our empire was laid not in the gloomy age of ignorance and superstition, but an epoch when the rights of mankind were better understood and more clearly defined. In this auspicious period, the United States came into existence as a nation, and if the citizens shall be not completely free and happy, the fault will be entirely their own." So I hear this as a direct challenge to each and every one of us to sort of take advantage and of this amazing system that they created for us and learn from that past, that epoch, when the rights of mankind were clearer and what it meant to be American was so well understood. And that's why I applaud this series and this organization to have that sort of amazing mission to take this history and keep it very much alive. And that was exactly my goal with writing this book. I wanted to take history of the past that seemed like it was dead and gone, to show that it's not. It is very much alive in spirit. And it does impact us today. So let's go to, I pushed the wrong thing. Okay, here we go. Yes. And it's alive and well in our Constitution. So I give a lot of talks to law schools around the country. And the way that this history directly impacts us via the law is by the Constitution. So I think there's a couple reasons to look to our past and our history to learn from it. So one is more the enlightened reason. These were amazing men and women. The women were very much a part of the Revolutionary War. Just look at some of Abigail Adams' letters, and she was a ferocious patriot, an amazing one. So men and women, they wrote about what, sort of the dilemmas and the moral problems that we still face today, and they grappled with them. So I think it's very enlightened of us to look back to them to see what can we learn? What did it mean to be American? How can we apply that to today? So I think that's one sort of high-minded reason to look to this history. A less high-minded reason is because whether we like it or not, it impacts modern law. And the majority of the Supreme Court judges throughout the country, stodgy academics like me, we all look to exactly this type of history as at least a starting point in interpreting what the Constitution means. So I originally started writing this as a student at Yale back in 2007. And to graduate from law school, I had to write this big paper. And I wrote the paper on, well, when they say in Article 2, the president should be commander-in-chief of the Army and Navy, what does that even mean? They don't really spell it out very much about what powers that entails. And throughout history, time and time again, we have so many battles between Congress and the president, with the Supreme Court, just back and forth. Well, the president can do X because of the Commander-in-Chief Clause, or the president cannot do Y because of the Commander-in-Chief Clause. But it's not very clear, and it's not a settled area of law of what that actually means. So I thought to myself, and I have to admit, I was sort of brainwashed into this way of thinking. Because of my upbringing, my family, we are indeed related to James Madison. Right? I call him Uncle Jimmy. And so that's where I got my height from. He was our shortest president at 5'4". But amazingly handsome. Well, I don't know about that. But I had this sort of brainwash into my mind that these men matter. When you see things today, there are probably echoes of the past. So why don't you look to see what you could learn from that past? So when I had to write this big paper, I decided, this was during the Second Iraq War, there's a lot of controversy about the Commander-in-Chief Clause, as you'll remember. And so I thought, okay, well, doesn't it make sense to look and see what the only American Commander-in-Chief we ever had when we wrote the document, what he had to say? What did he do? So what, can we look to specific instances during the Revolutionary War to see that when they wrote the Constitution and when they ratified it, what that guy at the front of the room did? Because to them, it was very real. It was practical. This was a practical Constitution they were creating that would set forth the way that the various branches of government would work. And it was very process-oriented, so they needed to know which branch could do what with regard to protecting the nation. So I went back and I started looking through Washington's primary, his own writings. I was very much focused on the primary sources because I feel that too often when you only read secondary sources, except for my book, of course, that's perfect in every way. But when you only read secondary sources, it gets distorted by the author. So I wanted to go right back to see, what did the founders themselves say? I don't have anything interesting to say. They do. So let's see their own words. So I went back, and I was looking at all the various documents, and I was finding time and again there are pretty clear parallels. If you strip away the technology and you look at the fundamental questions that we face, even things like drones. Washington didn't have planes, but he had means of distance killing. Or even torture, citizens' rights during wartime. These were all things that were sort of headline news back then, and now we're still seeing them. So I wanted to sort of see, okay, what can we learn from the past to help apply to today, to ground our conversation. So I write the paper, and it ends up winning this student award thing, and which meant I got passed around the faculty. And does anyone remember Professor Amy Chua, the Tiger Mom? Remember? Yeah. So she was my professor, and she gets a hold of it, and she calls me into her office. She says, "Who's Logan?" And so I go into her office, and I think I'm in big trouble because I'm thinking I'm touching upon some pretty hot button issues. And she says, "No, this should be a book." I said, "I can't write a book." She says, "You can, you will." So she started, became my Tiger professor, and we became very good friends. So by this point, I graduate. I'm working at a law firm, Sullivan Cromwell, down in New York. And it wasn't a blast, as you might expect. And so I was thinking to myself, how about that book idea? So I applied for the position back at Yale Law as an Olin Scholar to sort of to give me the chance to focus on this opportunity. And then writing the book, it comes out, and it ended up having a much larger response than I ever could have hoped for. Because my goal with this book has always been to take history, which may seem boring, outdated, and show it's not. It's relevant. It's entertaining. It's fun. So I tried to write a book that would sort of read like fiction, but actually be nonfiction. There are 1,400 footnotes, so the last 100 pages of the book you don't have to even read. as for the students back there, I know how they're thinking. So, but I want it to be very well documented, very academically sound, but actually enjoyable. So I hope I succeeded. And so where I was going with all of this. All right. So when the Revolutionary War starts in April of 1775, war breaks out. We have all sorts of problems with the British Crown and Parliament, not least of which are property rights. We see the British as violating our rights as British subjects at that point, and taking our land, taxing us without providing representation in Parliament, and this boils over in Lexington and Concord in April 1775. And what ends up happening is we have about 8,000 redcoats by June besieged within Boston by 20,000 irate militia. Now, these are farmers. These are shopkeepers. These are guys with guns. And they are angry. They are not trained, but they have the numbers on their side. So the British are not in a good spot. So the Continental Congress decides, we need someone to lead these troops, which Washington called the rabble, because he actually didn't have too high opinion of them at first either. It was very Southern versus New England. They didn't have a high opinion of New Englanders, the Southerners. So anyway, so they decide they want to create a commander-in-chief to lead these forces. However, they were very nervous about giving any military man too much power, because being Americans, they were very well versed in their history. And they saw that time and time again, when you give a military man too much power, he tends to keep it. So they were afraid of repeating this, and they wanted to create this new kind of American commander-in-chief. But they had no idea what that meant. Each person in Congress probably had their own opinion of what that meant. So they decided they were going to make it up as they went along. And this seems very haphazard, and it was. So they send Washington up to lead the forces in Boston, and he arrives. And he decides pretty quickly that strategically it makes a lot of sense to bombard the city. Just level it with the British in there, and they will surrender, we'll have a great victory, we'll take out that whole force. Being the commander-in-chief, you'd think he'd have the power to make such a tactical decision, but he doesn't. He wants to establish civilian authority over military rulers. Remember, we're trying to create this new kind of American commander that would help protect us as citizens without becoming our enemy himself. And that's actually why I called the book Blood of Tyrants, because it's getting at that balancing act between when Jefferson famously wrote, "The tree of liberty must be refreshed from time to time with the blood of patriots and tyrants." And if you think about that, that's really scary. So this idea that you have to bloodshed over and over again to protect our liberties, I think what the founders were trying to get at, they wanted to create a commander and later a president, who was powerful enough to protect us from foreign foes, but not so powerful that he would become a tyrant himself at home. So with this in mind, Washington decides, I will go and I will ask Congress if it's okay for me to bombard Boston. So Congress, as they are now, back then, they were great at forming committees. And they form a committee to oversee Washington. And it didn't matter the fact that the majority of the men in the committee had no military experience. That didn't faze them at all. So this committee tells Washington, no, you may not bombard Boston. So Washington says, okay, civilian control. It makes perfect military sense, but I won't. I'll bend the political pressure. And sure enough, we pay dearly for it, because the British, they evacuate up to Canada, and we know that the next battle will be in New York City, because New York City is one of the best ports in the world, and the British have, at this point, the most powerful navy in the world. So Washington goes down from... I'll use this pointer here. Oh. So he goes down from Boston to fortify New York City. Sure enough, during the summer of 1776 at this point, Washington is busy trying to fortify the city the best he can. But even Washington, who had not a stellar military record, he actually started off the book by talking about how he helped start the French and Indian War because due to a military blunder. He was in the woods in Pennsylvania, and he, by mistake, attacked a French diplomatic party, and his Native American allies slaughtered all the prisoners, inciting a world war. So Washington's military experience is mixed, to say the least. But he had shown to be brave and capable, so that's just why they gave him this power. But even with that sort of mixed background, even he realized, if you're fighting the most powerful navy on Earth, perhaps it's a bad idea to defend an island. Right? So he says to Congress, right, he sees the British ships show up off the coast, and he says to Congress, I think we should retreat. And Congress says no. In fact, John Adams writes to him saying, well, I have no military experience, but I still think politically it's important to make a defense of New York City. All right? So Washington, again, obeys. And again, we pay dearly for it, because in the Battle of Brooklyn, the British invade, and they quickly pin the Americans along the coast. And what happens, the only reason we're saved is by the weather. So today was a good example. So the weather changes every, what they say, if you don't like the weather, wait 5 minutes. This is definitely very true out in New England and New York City as well. What happened was, do you get nor'easters here? I don't know. You get the nor'easters. So we get, nor'easters where the wind is blowing for days from the northeast. Usually we only get them in the winter. But this was late August through the beginning of September of 1776. Very unusual for this time of year, a nor'easter rolls in. And what that does is winds blowing from the northeast make it impossible for the British ships to sail up it. So he keeps the East River open while pummeling the British with rain, and they decide, this will pass, we'll wait, and we'll get them in the morning. Well, Washington's not going to wait for that. So Washington decides, he confiscates all the boats along the southern port here. And he gets the fishermen, who are used to this kind of weather, to start ferrying the troops throughout the night. And what he does, as sun rises, he's still along the front line, because the back lines went first, and he's still there, because Washington was not the typical general that would sort of be, you've seen the movies, sort of watching from the spyglass from on the hill far away. Washington was always right there in the front lines with his troops. And that sort of helped inspire the confidence that we needed to keep fighting. He was still there when dawn came. It looked like time was up. But it wasn't, because, thankfully again, a dense fog rolled in, as if on cue. And they used that, and the fog was only here. For some reason, the East River was open, and they used that to ferry the rest of the men across and live to fight another day. So then he goes back to Congress, and he says again, I think we really need to retreat now. And Congress says, no, don't. We're gonna have another committee go and meet with them in Staten Island. That's over down here. In Staten Island to have a peace conference. Well, after these great victories, the British are not looking for peace. They know they could beat us. Sure enough, that was a disaster. And finally, after the Staten Island peace conference falls apart, gives Washington a few days to lick his wounds, Washington finally says again, okay, now may I go? They finally say, yes, you may. But it's basically too late because the British are invading. And Washington is busy running up Manhattan and is being chased by the British. There's some colorful stories in there in which the only reason half the army wasn't caught was because in Murray Hill, Mrs. Murray is now called Murray Hill and part of Manhattan, because Mrs. Murray she invited the British officers into her house, and she gave them lots and lots of wine, and it got them to tarry for hours, and that's how the Americans got away. That's somewhat lore, somewhat factual. Okay, so they escape, and they're being chased through New Jersey. And the British say, we have to bag the fox. That's the quote, because they want to bag Washington. Because what people don't realize about Washington, and what I don't think you'd learn in school, is that there would be no nation without him. If you had to point to one man that created this nation, it's him. Okay, why is that? It wasn't for necessarily his military prowess. He was a decent general, but not wonderful. It was because he was the political leader that united a very much fractured country. So let's go to the next. So it was basically 13 independent little commonwealths that were fighting with one another. The North hated the South hated the North. New England used to fight with New York over land. You name it. There was a trade war between New Jersey and New York. They were all fighting with one another, but what they needed was Washington to be sort of the principled moral force and have that gravitas that people would want to fight with him. And that's what actually held the nation together, was him, this man who was risking everything. He had built up quite a nice life for himself down in Virginia. But he was willing to risk it all in order to fight for these principles of liberty. And that was very much inspiring. And sure enough, every time winter came around, people would get a little cold and they'd tend to go home. And there'd be sort of a renewed patriotism, as I like to call it, every spring when it got warmer. But sure enough, Washington was enough of a force to glue the colonies together. So they decided, the British saw this. And a lot of times the British are painted as sort of blundering fools during the Revolutionary War. No. That does our troops a disservice, because we were fighting against the most powerful and cunning military force on the earth. And they were very astute. And so they realized that they need to get Washington. So they chase him through New Jersey. If you see what's happening now from the geography, Continental Congress is in Philadelphia, in Independence Hall. If anyone had a chance to visit, it's beautiful. So the war is morphing from a far-off war in Boston or even New York City, and they're starting to get very close to Philadelphia. And if the congressmen get captured, they will be hanged as traitors. So that's when they start changing their tune. In December of 1776, they grant Washington what they call dictatorial powers. All right, I know what you're thinking. Dictator, dirty word. However, it wasn't the dirty word back then that is now. To the founding era, when they heard dictator, they thought of the Roman Republic. Because again, they were very much into their history. And they would think of the Roman dictators, in which when there are times of extreme crisis, the Roman Senate would be dissolved, and they'd give all their power, military, political, you name it, to one man. And that one man would use that power to repel the threat, and then hopefully give it back. And one man who did, which was uncommon throughout history, was a man named Cincinnatus. He repelled the threat and went back to his farm after he did. And they're very much hoping that Washington would do the same. But again, being Americans, we don't just copy our history. We innovate. And the we put a twist on what it meant to be the American dictator. Because the Romans, they might have been willing to give away their political power and the rights of the citizens over to the hands of one man, but we sure weren't. So what they did was they divided the powers between the political power and the military power. And the political power remained with the sovereign. That's us, the electorate. And so that meant we retained our rights. We had the courts, the civilian courts were still functioning as much as possible. In many of the war-torn areas, it did break down, but they tried to get right back up again. The state legislatures were functioning as much as possible. Continental Congress was still functioning. And their goal was to still protect Americans' rights and liberties. So what did Washington get? Washington got what they would call a military dictatorship. And this meant that he, when it came to military power over his own troops or over defending us from foreign nationals, he had wide discretion. He was giving a far cry from this whole mother may I approach in Boston and New York. He became a much more empowered general who could decide what it took to defend his people. And he did so ruthlessly at times. Right soon after he received this power, he turns on the British and he goes back and he doubles back in Trenton and in Princeton. Actually, this is about Princeton before, and he uses this new nimble force. He didn't have to ask a committee anything. He could just go back and fight if he wanted to. And he basically went back in Trenton, surprised them there. And then the British are irate that the Americans won there, so they send more troops down. Washington goes around them and does another sneak attack at Princeton. And this is one of my favorite scenes, is about Princeton. And it shows a lot about Washington, because the British always said, even after the war, we didn't outfight the British, we outspied them. And Washington was masterful at being a spy master. So he was able to get reports back and learn the ways that defeating a more powerful force by using intelligence. And what he did was at the Battle of Princeton, again, another sneak attack in the early morning, and they have, and during the sneak attack, Washington is in the front lines, as usual, and he's caught between the two lines firing. So there were the, at one, the Americans on one side had their muskets lined up, and then the British on the other side had their muskets, and they crossfired. Washington was caught in that crossfire. And one of the patriots in his diary said that he covered his hat because the great general had to have been hit. But then from the smoke, he heard a booming voice, "It's a fine fox chase, boys, charge!" And that's sort of the inspiring. This man is in his time, he was seen as sort of a demigod. How could he possibly survive with this? He would have horses shot out from underneath him, and he'd say, "Get me a new horse." It was almost insane. In many ways, he thought of himself as invincible. He obviously wasn't, but that sort of gave him the courage and his troops the courage that they needed to keep fighting against a superior force. Okay, so, let's go this way. Okay, so let's. One good way to illustrate this whole. What were the implications of this whole military dictator that they created? Well, I found, which I don't find in other books mentioned very often, is this interesting divide with the way that the powers that Washington as commander in chief, that he had over American citizens versus the powers that he had over foreign nationals. And the best way to illustrate this is the story of Benedict Arnold. So Benedict Arnold, we all know, is the great traitor who tried to sell West Point to the British. Most people don't realize is that Benedict Arnold was one of our top generals during the early parts of the war. He was a smart man, quarrelsome man. He was from Connecticut. And he had in New Haven, he had a pharmacy. And he's great at making a buck. And that comes in handy later when he tries to sell West Point to the British. But so basically what happened was at the Battle of Saratoga, that's the time when that's sort of the great victory in which we're able to prove to the world that we can defeat the British in sort of conventional fighting, conventional warfare. And that's when the French decide they're going to become our allies. That victory was in large part thanks to Benedict Arnold and his bravery. But sure enough, Horatio Gates, his superior, actually he was sort of a stalking horse for Washington's job. He's a whole other character. He takes credit. And Arnold is just devastated by this. And he feels that the Americans have become just as bad, if not worse, than the British. So he might as well make a buck. And if the British are going to win anyway, because it looked like they were, he might as well become rich and go to the winning side. So he decides to try to sell West Point. West Point is right here. You can see faintly, it's probably hard, from the back point, it's probably hard to see, but the Hudson River is right along here. Now, think about it. The British own, they have Canada, and if they could control with their ships the Hudson River, they could cut out the New England states. And this is the hotbed of rebellion where a lot of the men and the food munitions were coming from. And if they could cut that, they could cut the country in half, and then they could pick off the other states one by one. Washington realizes this, and since we don't have a navy, he decides to use a land-based defense. Now, has anyone had a chance to visit West Point? Okay, great. So you know what I'm talking. So it's a beautiful it's a beautiful place that has very interesting geography. To us, we see it and we think, oh, that's just it's a gorgeous river with a severe bend. And it makes it very beautiful, good for pictures and things. But for back then, that meant in that bend in the river, the British needed to tack. They needed to tack their ships, which made them very vulnerable to the cannon. So Washington used this natural location to build a fort and have cannon ready to fire upon the ships. And he also ran what they called a great chain, which each link was like probably about this big, some bigger. Across the river to block it from the British ships. So he has them bottled down here and keeps it free so the people and supplies can go across the northern place. Arnold realizes that this is crucial, and therefore he gets a lot of money for it. So he just lobbies Washington for control of West Point. Washington has a lot of respect for this young man, and he gives it to him. And so what he does is Arnold starts using his power as the commander of West Point to start looking for ways that the weak points in the fortifications, and just writing up plans to tell the British exactly how to attack and get past their defenses. Because his goal was to make it look like he was putting up a fight, but really quickly have the British win, so then he could go to Washington again and get another appointment and do this again and again. However, he's working with a man named John André. Now, John André is a British intelligence officer who's operating out of New York City. And André is sort of a sympathetic character because there's all this sad story where he was only there because his fiancée dumped him. He was more into poetry than warfare. So he's sort of a sympathetic guy. But he was working with Arnold, who was not as sympathetic. And he's getting the plans. So Arnold is giving the plans to John André and then American loyalists. So during the Revolutionary War, 40% of the it fluctuated. But roughly 40% of the population were patriots, so not even the majority. Roughly 40% were on the fence, going back and forth, didn't want to be involved. And the remaining 20% were loyalists who actively wanted the British to win. So he was one of the loyalists, and he was working to deliver André and the papers back down from West Point down to New York City, which was British-controlled. Luckily, they were captured. So they captured John André, and they found in his boots the plans for West Point. So even though all signs pointed right back to Arnold, no one could conceive or even fathom that he could possibly be involved in such treachery. They quickly send communication back to West Point saying, Arnold, you better be ready. Someone's going to attack you. So Arnold, of course, says, well, oh, that's terrible. Ready my boat. And sure enough, they do, and he gets away in his boat as Washington's approaching. So Arnold gets away. But they do have the two co-conspirators. They have the British, André, and the American loyalist Joshua Hett Smith. Washington is irate. He says to Joshua Hett Smith, the American, he says, "I have enough evidence to hang you on yonder tree without a trial." And he wants to, because Washington is angered by such disloyalty. He is scared about how far-reaching this conspiracy is. So he needs to quash this thing before it destroys the American cause. But he doesn't hang on Joshua Hett Smith, the American. Instead, he provides him with due process. He gives him a trial, which is strange, because this man, who's pretty much guilty of sin, you could even read his autobiography. He wrote this self-aggrandizing autobiography later, and even in that, you could read between the lines, and you could tell he knew what he was doing. But again, Washington wants to set this precedent in which American citizens have rights, and the military, and the commander-in-chief, all the power he may have, he cannot strip that from them. So what he does is he has a weeks-long trial, and Smith is able to convince them, even though he has top military brass arguing against him, he has witnesses, you name it, he's able to convince them. He said, okay, maybe I did all of these things, but you can't prove that I didn't think I was merely following a general's orders, that general being Arnold. And if I'm just following orders, I don't know what I'm doing is wrong, you can't convict me. And sure enough, the Americans say, you know what, we're going to set, as much as despicable as you are, we want to set a precedent, and he gets off. He's acquitted. He's actually taken in on other charges, and he's taken to prison in Connecticut. But then there's this whole strange story where he escapes dressed as a transvestite and gets back into New York City. He gets away. The same could not be said for John Andre. Now, John Andre is the more sympathetic character. Smith was sort of a sniveling guy that no one seemed to like very much. Andre is the British intelligence officer. His argument is, I'm a British intelligence officer. I'm supposed to be doing this. But they said, no, you were caught in disguise in American territory relaying secret information. You were a spy. And he doesn't give him any kind of due process. He is hanged within days. Washington wanted to send a very clear message. If you threatened his people, he would destroy you. So I think that this creates sort of a lasting precedent, and sort of the powers that the president has to defend us from threats. But then when it comes into play, a lot recently, even looking at NSA surveillance and things like that, sort of the different approach the commander-in-chief was meant to take when it involved us at home. So after the war, Washington was the great celebrated hero who was seen as the one man, the demigod. He was sort of seen as a demigod in his own time. This is not a situation where after the fact history has made him bigger and bigger. He was seen as a demigod in his own time. This man was able to lead the nation, and when it came, the nation started to fall apart after the war, and they had to write a constitution to sort of create some sort of process by which we might govern ourselves. They call Washington back out of retirement, because he was back on his farm loving it with Martha, but they call him back out of retirement, the last thing he wants to do, and they put him back at that constitutional convention in which he's the president, and everyone knows that when they do finally ratify this constitution and elect the first president, he will be the man. So when they wrote the powers of the presidency, this was the man that they had in mind. Not only did he lead them to victory, not only was he the president of the convention in which they drafted the convention, not only was he crucial to getting the constitution passed by arguing that the electorate vote for and ratify it, they also knew that he would be the first American president. So I love to open this up for questions. We could about history. We could apply it to modern times. There's so many ways we could go with this. I'm happy to have questions now. And then if I don't get your question now, I believe there'll be some time for some one-on-one question later as well. Thank you, everyone. Please. Oh, yeah, absolutely. I did. It's always, it's always aim for the high ground. That's not just a saying, because militarily it makes perfect sense, especially back then. And I think, you hit upon a very important point, was that Washington, not necessarily our best general or tactician, but politically he was genius, because what he saw was not what everyone else saw. So a typical general would sort of, use those sorts of tactics, use the high ground to win battle by battle. Washington was thinking big picture. He was the first to sort of play for the hearts and minds. We use that phrase now. Washington, he was thinking that way back then. And this was unheard of for a lot of history. And so what he was trying to do was, he realized something that few generals throughout history have realized, and that is, it's not necessarily, you don't win the war necessarily by holding land. Because technically, in battle, the side that ends up with the land after the battle, that's the technical victor. Washington didn't care about technicalities. He cared about wearing down the British. So we had lots of land. So if he wanted to, he would have a skirmish, retreat. Skirmish, retreat. This is known as the Fabian strategy, named after Fabius in Roman Republic. And so basically using this strategy, he was wearing down the British, because he saw something that's, probably rings true a lot to us now. And that is, if he could keep the British army in the field and he could keep the Continental army intact, so the British have to be there to fight them, he's draining the taxpayers in Britain. And you're going to win the war by convincing those British taxpayers that they're done. And so what he keeps doing, he gives up... he gave up. He retreated from New York. He retreated through New Jersey. Had a couple battles that he won. Then retreated again. Gave up Philadelphia, and the Continental Congress was not happy with that one, because they had to. They actually went to Baltimore. Which, are there any Baltimoreans in here? Oh, good, because Adams called that the most damnedest hellhole on earth. So they weren't happy being there. But Washington saw something that they didn't, and that was, I need to create this. I need to preserve my army. And so while he was doing that, he was also crafting them into be sort of the moral superiors of their British foes. So he'd do this by working to literally down to the point of minding your manners, no swearing, no drinking, no skinny dipping in the company of refined women, things like that. That these are direct quotes. But so he would do this, and he was trying to do his show that the American army was a moral force. It was we were the good guys. And he wanted to prove, because remember, 40-40-20, the nation was split about which side they were on. So if he could show that we are the good guys, we are fighting for the righteous cause, then he could get more recruits. And that's how he's going to win the hearts and minds to better the superior British forces.
Please.
Absolutely. So Washington had fought for the Virginia militia. The question was, in England, did they know about Washington? Was he well known, and would people sympathize with him? And the answer is yes. So Washington, during the French and Indian War, he had fought for the Virginia militia. And he had tried very hard to get a commission in the Royal Army, because that was Washington people, a lot of people think that he came from an aristocratic background. He was actually middle class, and he wanted to use adventure and war to raise his lot in life. And the way to do this was to become part of the Royal Army. Well, he didn't get it. He didn't do well enough to get the commission. And so, you know, some of the officers they ended up fighting against later knew him when he fought under them as part of the militia. So they knew him that way. And he had gotten some publicity for starting the war, the French and Indian War. Someone said, you know, they called him, you know, I'm trying to think of the direct quote. It was something along the lines of, a madman from Virginia has sparked a world war, and it was Washington's blunder that caused the war. So he was maybe a little bit notoriety for starting the war. But people became fascinated in Britain of this sort of, they saw him a lot as this frontiersman. And this is what Franklin, when he was in France, played up as well. People had this sort of, they were drawn to this idea of the American frontiersman, even though these people weren't living in the frontier at this point as much. But this notion, and a lot of them sympathize with these people. And sort of their demands that they be treated like British subjects and be given the right to vote in Parliament seem reasonable. At the same time, the vast majority of the British were against the colonists because the way they saw it was, we are funding your defense from the Native Americans, from the French. So you need to pay your fair share. And that's the way they saw things. So there, you know, people did know about Washington. They were, because they were fascinated with this, with the colonies and also the war. There were some sympathizers because they were sort of drawn to this sort of idea of this American frontier. But the most were against him. Thank you. Please.
Did Washington have any philosophers or military heroes that he kind of used as a model of someone he guided?
He did, and the question again. Did Washington have any philosophers or military heroes that he looked up to from the past? And he did. Washington didn't have the classical education that Jefferson did or even that Madison did. And that was because his father died when he was 10. And so he never got the European education, the proper education for someone who wanted to be a part of the gentry of Virginia. And so he actually had a chip on his shoulder his whole life because he was sort of self-educated to a large degree. But he would try. He was not nearly as well-versed in the classics as a lot of the other founders, but he tried to. And he would look to a lot of the Roman generals for guidance. And he was a huge admirer of Cincinnatus, who I mentioned before, this whole idea of taking great power and responsibility, but then graciously returning it to the people because it was their power to be give away. And then also the Fabian strategy. Again, this idea from antiquity of having small battles and then retreating, giving up land in order to preserve your force, that being the most powerful, most important thing to win the war. And he looked to those men in particular, and he tried to, you know, educate himself as much as possible. But that, you know, that being said, I think too often in history, Washington is seen as sort of not the brains of the revolution. He's seen as sort of the brawn. And I think that's a huge mistake. I think that Washington was the brains, but there's different kinds of intelligence. There's sort of the Jeffersonian sort of philosophical intelligence. Washington had practical and political intelligence. He could navigate the politics of the time and had this amazing, mostly innate sense of what he needed to do to get the political factions on his side, what he needed to do to divide the political factions in Britain to get his victory. And he had this genius, you know, one good story to sort of illustrate this is when the Conway Cabal, when Horatio Gates, who I mentioned before, was sort of the stalking horse for Washington's job. And Washington handled this very, very unusually. So he received a letter in which Conway, one of his officers, who was mad at Washington because Washington didn't give him a promotion. So Washington doesn't get the promotion because there's a lot more able men than you. You're not getting it. So Conway turns against him and says, oh, well, let's make Gates commander-in-chief instead. And Washington intercepts his letter. So you think, you know, this day and age, a lot of times, it would turn into this whole shouting match of some sort in which there'd be letters back and forth. That's not the way Washington played. Washington instead forwarded the letter to Gates, copying Conway, saying, your letter was inadvertently sent to me. Please find it enclosed. Period. Now, Washington was, again, not who was this moral force. He was a large, powerful man who was very much respected by his troops. So by doing this, in sort of responding in this way, he was seen as magnanimous and sort of above the fray. And so this gets back to Congress, what happened. And quickly, everyone's in Congress, they start turning against one another and saying, oh, it wasn't me. And then Gates writes to Washington, I'm so sorry, I didn't write that. I didn't encourage this. And Conway tries to say, oh, that wasn't my writing. I meant to say this. And Washington just was completely silent. And it collapsed on itself. So that's one sort of using this political knack to navigate some perilous times. Please. That's a great question, and I think it's interesting because the founders hoped the Constitution would last as long, but they certainly didn't expect it to, because the Articles of Confederation were ratified in 1783, and by 1787 they had fallen apart. So they thought this Constitution might not even be passed because it was pretty controversial. And if it is passed, where do we go from there? So you're right. So Washington was sort of the linchpin and sort of, driving this through. And what I argue at this point is that, especially, I focus my research mostly on the commander-in-chief power, so I do look at that clause in particular. And with regard to that clause, he saw it very much as a continuation of what he had established as commander-in-chief of the Continental Army. So, after the December of 1776, in which he was sort of given those broader powers, from then on, there's sort of a, more of a happy medium of what powers they understood Washington to have. After the beginning, it was sort of fits and starts about who can do what, and it sort of became more clear—not completely clear, but more clear about what powers the commander would have throughout the rest of the war. And so, when it came to that, Washington. He tried to stick to that, but there were obviously some challenges. Think of the Whiskey Rebellion that cropped up, and Washington was put to the test. And, he did his best. He was keen on, we saw time and again throughout the war, of even short-term loss in order for a longer-term principal victory. And I think that's the one. I can talk to you more after this, but sort of the one sort of defining thing that I could say about his presidency is that he hoped he was setting the precedent for presidencies in the future. So he was meticulous about not only acting such a way that people would emulate him, but two, writing everything down. And that was of great benefit to me in writing this book, because I could go see them. But yeah, thanks. Oh, please, sir.
From your legal question, obviously the war was pretty defined as who the enemy was and who we were, but since the Constitution, Congress is responsible for declaring war. Mm-hmm. We haven't had a declared war.
It's nebulous,
trying to define one, the enemy, and
what's your feeling about the commander-in-chief powers in this kind of nebulous area mm-hmm. of the Defense Department, according to Wall Street Journal, has 10,000 lawyers?
Mm-hmm.
So you're putting everything in a legal context.
There are too many lawyers. That's why I retired.
So how do you find the enemy?
Absolutely. And I think sort of there are two main points there. First, define the enemy. I think, you know, there are some parallels with regard to define the enemy because for us, it wasn't quite so clear when you start thinking about the loyalists because a lot of them would take up arms against us. So those are American citizens who are the enemy. So there was some, sort of some nebulousness there, but the sort of the second point you were getting at was the power to declare war in Congress, having that power. They actually went back during the convention, went back and forth on this, and they changed the wording slightly from the power to make war versus the power to declare war. And what they were getting at with that was that they viewed, and this is in Madison's notes, they viewed sort of the commander-in-chief as a dog on a leash. And it was Congress's power to let the dog off that leash. And once Congress let the dog off the leash, he had a lot of discretion. Again, not over the citizens, but over the foreign nationals. And that's the way they had set it up. It quickly came into practice that, you know, a formal declaration of war, the last one was World War II, was not always necessary. So, I mean, the Barbary Pirates are the first example. And in that, there was congressional authorization to do so, but there's no declaration of war. And so Madison and under Jefferson, they fight these skirmishes with these pirates in the Mediterranean without any declaration of war. And this sort of sets this there was confusion over what, you know, whether it was legal or whether it was not legal. But the general consensus was when it comes to sort of defensive actions, then the commander-in-chief does have a lot of discretion. When it comes to offensive actions, he needs to be let off the leash. But you know, I realize that's a slippery slope because then throughout time, as we've seen, we start defining more and more things as defensive. We never say, oh, no, we're going to go take out this country and, you know, get oil or whatever. We're going to – instead we say things like, well, in order to defend ourselves, we have to take out this group or that group. And, you know, I'm not a particularly political person. But sort of, you know, one issue that's sort of coming up most recently is sort of the power of the president to send forces into Syria, you know, to be bombing Syria and things like that. And I think that the founders, as originally intended, they would have contemplated congressional involvement in that sort of action because this is Syria is a sovereign nation. It's hard to argue that there are American, you know, there obviously has been beheadings and awful things happening. But it's hard to say, you know, to argue that these bombings will directly defend American citizens. So, you know, I'm not getting into whether it makes sense to or not, but as far as process is concerned, you know, they would contemplate, rigorous congressional involvement in such an action. Thank you. So the question was, you know, what were the biggest surprises from Washington, sort of the misunderstandings about him? And I love that question. So there's so many misunderstandings about Washington. Even just a few quick myths I'll dispel, and then I'll get to the biggest. You know, his teeth were not wooden. I'll put that to rest. They were actually, it's pretty gross. They were hippopotamus ivory and human teeth. And he wouldn't brush them, so they would decay, and they'd look like wood. So it wasn't great. So Washington was hated giving speeches because people think he has a certain, again, another misconception. They think that he had a very loud, commanding presence and voice. He didn't. He sort of had a kind of a wispy voice, and his speech was garbled because of his teeth. So he did not. He was not one to give grand speeches. Another misconception, the cherry tree. That's a myth. He did not chop down any cherry tree, or he did, but he never had the whole "I can't tell a lie" part of it. But you know what that you know what's getting at was correct is that Washington was an incredibly moral and principled man. And I think sort of the main takeaway and the biggest surprise to me was I was just saying to a few people that when you look at historical figures, Washington is by far the most impressive the more you get to know him. So I learned, I think of the man in the dollar bill, sort of, you know, sort of sitting there, old, unapproachable. And actually, Gilbert Stuart, who painted that portrait that was used for the dollar, was not a fan of Washington, actually, which was very rare, because Washington was very much beloved. But this Gilbert Stuart, he was sort of a jovial Irishman who would, I could say I am one. So he, and he would sort of get, he'd loosen up his subjects with jokes. And Washington had no room in his life, and he was a president at this point, or time for this man's banter. So Gilbert Stuart said, let's just pretend for a second, forget that you're the president and I'm just a mere painter, just, you know, loosen up. And Washington said, you would do well to remember that I am the president and you are a painter. So Washington was a stern man, so that's why you see on the dollar bill, that's why he looks like that. But what I think what people miss about Washington, he was an incredibly dynamic, powerful leader. He was a great dancer. He was a great athlete. He was one of the best horseback riders America's ever had. And sort of, he was this dynamic man who was, what I was saying before, he was a political genius. People don't give him credit for that. And the way that he was able to navigate the war and navigate his own Congress in order to bring himself into power is what created this nation. Thank you.